Welcome to Wellness Radio with Dr. Jeanette Gallagher as your host. Her show discusses topics of health, wellness, and spirituality and is about discovering your place in this great universe from your cells to the cosmos. Along with her guest, in casual conversation, she strives to ask the difficult questions that may be holding you back from a vibrant life and shares new ideas that may inspire you to make a change in your life that you only can see in your dreams. And now, here is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Wellness Radio. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and it's a pleasure to have you with us here today. Today we are going to be talking about a great topic that I think is finding its way into almost everyone's home these days. If you have a bunch of women together, as we would say, they all have kids. They all have children who have issues. It seems like somebody's always sick these days. Has anybody noticed that? Or people will say, you know what, my kids are sick all the time. Or further still, people will not even, I think, open up these days about their children that are really chronically ill because they really don't know what to say, they don't know how to get help, and they really don't want to be judged or ostracized by their peer group. Anyone ever notice that? How about when you say as an adult, you say you don't feel well? Do you feel like you have 100 people around you that have all got their well-meaning comments and their little digs and do this, do that, and then the next day, did you do what I told you to do? We all know about that, right? Today we're going to be talking about a great book by Patty Wood. It's called Helping to Heal. And what I think it is great about it is that it's just a small, simple book you can give to a parent, and you could say, you know, I know your child's had a lot of concerns these days. Maybe something in here will help them to heal. And maybe something you can do in your home, or maybe something in the way you're being able to help your children feel better. And I think that's important because there's so much overwhelming information these days. There's the internet, there's all these blog posts, you know, and you almost get to feel like you're being bullied or pressured into stuff that you don't know anything about, and you try it, and you might do it haphazardly, and you feel like, I don't really know where I'm going here, so I'm just going to throw up my hands, and I don't know what I'm going to do. So this book is a great guide for a new parent or a parent of a child that is ill to say, hey, you know what? I do that. Maybe I won't do that anymore. Or, oh, I think I'm going to try that. That's something simple. And just have a little book of reference to say, hey, something else that I think I can help my child with. So, Patty, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
You're so welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
Patty, don't you think this peer pressure is getting to be tremendous with people these days?
Well, I think that it's a bit overwhelming for parents today, even as opposed to, you know, 20 years ago or even 10 years ago. There are a lot of things to think about now when we bring a child into the world. And as you have just talked about, there's even a lot more to think about when you have a child who is suffering from an illness, especially a chronic illness, where you know that you're going to have to help this child, you know, along the way as they grow.
Right. Well, your book is called Helping to Heal. Can you tell me us a little bit about why you decided to write this book and what type of work you do? We'd love to know.
Yeah, so Helping to Heal came from, the idea came from actually one of our board members of our environmental health nonprofit organization. And she had recently moved into a new neighborhood and had a new home, and she had neighbors that she met on either side of her that had children who were suffering from cancer. And she just was kind of overwhelmed with that and said, you know, these parents, you know, I watch them day in and day out getting in and out of their cars and, you know, going to the hospital and taking their children for doctor's appointments. And, you know, they're just walking around with, you know, this blank stare and, you know, wondering, you know, what they can do. I mean, keep in mind that, you know, a parent's natural instinct is to nurture and protect. And when a child has been diagnosed with a really serious life-threatening illness, all of a sudden that care, you know, has been given over to, you know, radiation, you know, experts and oncologists and pediatric oncologists and so on. And so parents feel a little bit that, you know, they have been put aside, and that mm-hmm. their input is not as important, whereas it really is. And so this board member of ours said, you know, could you actually put down in a book in a very simple way all the things that you do at your nonprofit? And we educate the public about the links between common environmental exposures and human health, and nutrition is something that we consider an environmental exposure. And so she said it would give these parents something to do, something proactive to do, to make them partners in their child's healing process. And I agreed 100%. You know, we know that children are already uniquely vulnerable, just because of their size, because of their developing bodies, their underdeveloped immune systems and detoxification systems, and so on and so on. And pound for pound, children take in more of environmental contaminants than we do. They drink more water, they breathe more air, and they eat more food per pound of body weight. And so we are already talking about a vulnerable population, but when you have a sick child, that's a case where you have a child who's even more vulnerable. And so that's what I did. I looked at two things that parents and only parents can do for children who are suffering from serious illness, and that one is providing optimal nutrition, and the other is to make their home as safe an environment as possible.
Because I think so, too, when parents notice that a child is sick, they put so much focus on the child. They don't focus on themselves either, nor do they focus on how they may have gotten there. In other words, if you make a child something different for their nutrition, you say, why are we not all doing this? In other words,
exactly.
I'm going to feed my child healthy foods,
yeah.
but we're still going to stop at McDonald's on the way home from work, you know, that kind of idea.
Yeah, but you're absolutely right. That doesn't happen. That doesn't happen.
Right.
They actually, the whole family begins to eat healthier. Everybody benefits from this.
Yeah, so this book really is about helping everyone. And I think that the book is in a very, it's not overwhelming, number one, but also number two, it's not in a really I'm going to make you wrong kind of idea. Because so many parents feel that if a child is sick, there's something that they did wrong, you know. It's not confronting them with the concept that they haven't done the job right, and now look at the results, they're hurting their child. So it's really, it's very simple, and it just says, simply stated, you know, here's a statement, here's how you can look at it, here's where you can find more references, which is really great. So it doesn't really confront them with, you know, that slap on the wrist that they didn't do something right.
Well, and for the most part, they didn't do anything wrong. I mean, a lot of the environmental health issues that we speak about in the book, or that I talk about in the book, are emerging issues. I mean, the science is still
mm-hmm.
developing on a lot of these issues, but we, as an environmental health organization, as a science-based organization, are really guided by the precautionary principle, which says that when there's an indication of harm, even without scientific certainty, and we know, if you know the science world at all, scientific certainty, you know, in some cases is almost impossible to obtain. Just because you'll always have researchers who will, you know, design a study and it will counter another study that's already been done. And so you can go back and forth. I mean, there are still people that say that cigarettes don't cause lung cancer because they have science. They have designed a study that actually proves that. So it's really hard. But when we're talking about our children, we're talking about something simple. We're talking about not doing no harm to anyone just by taking precaution. Why wouldn't we do it? Especially when we have good science, independent science, academic peer-reviewed science that actually links exposures to harm.
And it's also the thought that why would you actually put yourself in the position and wait for science to be able to tell you it's okay? Science has changed. I mean, if you can look at the early 1900s, cocaine and all of these other drugs were used as medicines. So look how far we've come in just 100 years, you know? So if you want to keep waiting, I mean, if it's something that you think, hey, this doesn't resonate with me, this doesn't sound right, it doesn't feel right, maybe the issue has been raised, maybe I will just avoid it. It's not necessary to my life. It's not something that I must have, or it's not something that makes the wheel go round. I can do quite well without it, so I'll just avoid it. And that's pretty much the theory that we should really be living upon, because, you know, that whole theory of more is better is not has been really kicked to the curb, I think, in the past probably 5 years. More is not always better, you know.
Well, you're absolutely right. And if you think back 100 years ago, our biggest public health threat was infectious disease. And now the scientists are telling us, and the medical establishment is basically agreeing that environmentally mediated disease is our biggest public health threat. And so, you know, we take a vulnerable child, and then you say, okay, this child is going through, you know, treatments that are going to weaken them, perhaps, you know, destroy their immune system for a certain amount of time. And you want to make sure that they're not being exposed to anything in the environment or eating food that is not actually supporting a healthy immune system while they're going through this. It's just critically important. And these are things that only parents can do. You know, the doctor is not going to come into your home and start preparing a meal. It's a parent.
Some doctors,
and they
okay.
are really they are best qualified. They are best qualified. Parents are best qualified to address this very, very important component of their child's healing process. And it's never really been put down anywhere before. We did a lot of research to see whether, you know, there was something, you know, a guidebook or, you know, some kind of a guidance for parents even on the internet about how to support your child at home when they are going through treatment for a life-threatening illness, and there really wasn't anything there. And like you said, it was written in a way where, you know, parents didn't feel overwhelmed or threatened mm-hmm. or guilty about anything that they have done. These are things that we all need to think about, even if we have healthy children. You know, we need to think about it. We can't be blind anymore to, you know, to what's happening around us because the environment is full of risk today.
Right. And, you know, this let's talk a little bit about fast food, processed food. A lot of times, you know, people can't wait until their child gets their first teeth. We all know where their first stop is. It's at that French fry place. And people are so excited, they post pictures of it. Oh, he can finally eat that French fry. And you're going, yikes, you know. But some people say, oh, it's cool. So really to think about that, when was your first time that you had a lot of processed foods or when you had a lot of fast foods, you know? Why are you still not feeding your child at home? I think so many people say, I have some friends, we live in the Deep South. And they'll say, you know, when you go out to eat, they're always out to eat. And I had asked a group of friends, I said, how many times do you cook at home? And they were almost overwhelmed with it. They said, well, we heat up leftovers we brought home from the restaurant. And I said, do you not cook a meal? And probably less than 10% of their meals per month were actually cooked at home, whereas mine are 100% because I just don't eat out. And it's such a different concept with so many different people. They say, well, what do you mean about eating nutritious food? You know, I can get a salad at that drive-through, and you're still saying, but you're still not understanding that, you know, that's only a piece of the puzzle.
Right. I love this thinking, this process that you're going through over this whole thing, because it's so true. When we have a newborn infant, we are so concerned about their nutrition. Are they getting the right nutrients? Are they nursing well? Are they, you know, are they taking enough formula? We actually measure how much formula. We go to the doctor every single month for those well baby checkups, and we see how well our child is growing. They check the head circumference. They check their length and their height, and their weight, and their, you know, we're just so concerned about good nutrition. For about how long? About 18 months as we continue to take this new baby. So we're so good. And then they say, oh, you know, mashed banana, you know, and a little bit of avocado for first foods, maybe some sweet potato, you know, and then so we're so careful. So they're getting breast milk and they're getting all of these mashed foods. And exactly as you said, as soon as they can walk, they walk those children right into McDonald's for a Happy Meal. It is the most amazing thing to me that parents are so concerned about nutrition just until their children can walk and they stop doing these well baby visits, you know, at the pediatrician, and then boom, they're right into quote unquote the fun food. Because food is supposed to be fun. I hear this so much from parents. They say, oh, well, food is fun. You know, you want to make it fun. I'm like, holy smoke. My kids thought that sorting beans was fun. You know, I'd give them each a cookie sheet, dump in the beans, and they'd have to take out anything that looked funny or little pieces of, you know, straw or whatever. And then we'd wash them, and then we'd boil them. And, you know, we put a little bit of vinegar in them, let them soak for a couple of days. I mean, it's like, you know, it was all a process, but that was fun too. And then at the end of the day, they were eating a healthy food. So I don't know. I mean, I've always worked full time too, so it's not like you can't do it. You just need to, I think, prioritize as a parent and understand that really, really good nutrition is critical. And that's what I talk about in the first part of the book is nutrition, because it is so important. And then we also talk about in the book how you store your food, how you cook your food, what materials are you using, what pans are you using, because, you know, there are some chemicals, in some of the cookware that we have, and barbecuing and, you know, that kind of thing are just, you know, things to think about. And where do you get your water? Are you just buying bottled water? You know, is that safe? Well, there's really very little regulation on bottled water in this country. So it's in most cases not as safe or just as safe as tap water, depending on where it comes from.
Okay, so, you know, and Patty, also, too, we look at our food and what we cook it in. There's pots, there's cans, there's plastic containers, there's the chemicals in our home. That's a really big mountain to climb. And I think the first one or two steps so many people can do is throw away certain type of pots that they use to cook in and throw away all the plastic containers in their house and don't microwave. Well, sorry, there's three. What do you think?
Well, I absolutely agree. Microwaving is not a good idea. I know that it's incredibly convenient, and most homes and condos and apartments, even when you buy them, they already have a microwave in them as part of their kitchen equipment. But as well as being concerned about the non-uniform heating of foods that can contain harmful bacteria, the leaching of the chemicals from the plastic containers into the food while they're heating is, from our perspective, you know, a very great risk. So there are a lot of plasticizing chemicals, which means that, you know, these plastic containers that are made are designed to be flexible, not to crack, not to melt. And so you need to put chemicals into the plastic in order to create those properties. And unfortunately, when food is heated or when the plastic is heated, it will actually leach some of these chemicals into the food that you're storing or heating in them. So these risks are really easily avoided by using, glass or Pyrex or Corningware, lead-free ceramic. And just be careful when you see plastic containers that are labeled microwave safe. It really only means that it's not going to melt or crack when you heat it. But I always tell people, don't eat food that comes in plastic and don't cook it in plastic. Just remove plastic from food. and drink. It's just very important that we're not actually getting our food and eating it out of plastic or cooking it in it.
Even that, we're talking about plastic. There's a lot of homes. They bring all of this stuff home in those foam things or whatever, you know, those takeout containers, and they just throw it in the microwave, and I'm going,
That's terrifying. I mean, that is terrifying.
To me it is.
because the plastic containers are made from styrofoam, and styrofoam or polystyrene is the actual chemical name of that that material. Is that, you know, styrene is a known human carcinogen, and styrene actually leaches very readily out of styrofoam or polystyrene containers. What's interesting is that it leaches into hot liquids, and you know, you go to a place to get a cup of coffee, and it almost always comes in a styrofoam cup, and it's like, are you kidding? You know, hot chocolate, tea, coffee, and all that stuff is leaching, into those drinks. It's amazing.
Yep.
So styrofoam of all the plastics besides PVC, which is not typically used for food and drink containers, but I would just avoid plastic completely.
You know, and it's interesting, when you get the coffee in those cups, it's burning hot, so you know it's even has a more of a potential to leak into there.
Oh, yeah.
And then,
And
then people take it to work, and then when it gets cold, they say, oh, my coffee's cold, I got to go reheat it. They shove it in the microwave, and you just say, let that one drop.
Well, the other thing is that, you know, a lot of people, you know, when they do go out and they buy cookware, they usually buy these cookware, brands that are nonstick, just because it's easier to clean. They're cheap, they're lightweight, they can be found, just about anywhere. And the problem with that is that it contains these chemicals that are called perfluorinated octanoic acids that actually emit toxic fumes when they're heated to high temperatures. They also scratch easily if you're not using a wooden spoon in them, and that can actually contaminate food with loosened particles of this PFOA. This particular chemical is one of two chemicals that we're really concerned about, this nonstick chemical that is also used for clothing. It's used for all kinds of things because it makes containers water repellent and stain resistant as well. We always look at water repellent things and avoid them. We look at stain resistant things and avoid them. And unfortunately, a lot of the takeout food that you mentioned earlier that people are getting from restaurants comes in paper containers that are lined with kind of a plasticized, inside, and that contains also the PFOA. If you see, it does not leach or does not stain, the grease does not go through those containers, and that's because it has that chemical on the inside of it. So we tell people to be careful about that. I know it's really hard to say, bring your own, glass container to a takeout place and ask them to put it in your own container, but I've actually seen more and more people doing that, which is quite amazing.
Really? Forget it. I think I always say to everybody, just order what you're going to eat, and if you're not sure, order one thing, and when we're finished with it, we'll order something else. I just don't take takeout. I just don't bring anything home. It just doesn't make sense to me, you know?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, we have an office, and people go out at lunchtime, and they bring they bring these containers in from a place right across the street, a Japanese restaurant or whatever. And I'll just say, we're going over there, and we eat off a china plate, and with real metal utensils, and they take it away and they wash them, and we're not creating waste as well.
Yeah.
So that's another whole issue, is all of the plastic waste that goes into the waste stream.
Well, that brings us right back to the nutrition fact, too. When you're feeding your child, you need to feed that child one of those little Happy Meal things or a child's meal that comes on the menu, or can you be giving your child the regular food that should be eaten, which is maybe your beef and broccoli you should be giving them instead of chicken fingers and French fries,
Absolutely.
It's such a concept. You just look at it and you say, what am I doing? What am I creating,
I think if parents are listening right now, one of the things that hopefully will stick is that when you cook foods at high temperatures, especially things that are carbohydrate rich, which would be potatoes, and also your baked goods, any kind of baked goods. But when you cook them at high temperatures, such as frying or heating them or baking them at high temperatures, you are creating a chemical called acrylamide. And it is actually naturally formed from foods that are high in carbohydrates. And it is widely recognized, and the World Health Organization, the WHO, is really quite at loose ends. They don't really know what to do about it because it's found in incredibly high levels, especially in things like potato chips and French fries, which we were just talking about. So I always tell parents to try to avoid any kind of fried foods that are rich in carbohydrates, which would be French fries and potato chips and so on. You should really discard burned or over-browned toast and baked goods because they also are likely to contain high levels of acrylamide. And it is a known human carcinogen and actually quite potent. If you look up acrylamide on the internet, you will be amazed at what you find. And it's all these very conservative institutions. It's not fringe, health, alternative health people who are talking about acrylamide. It is really the National Institutes of Health. It is the EPA. It is the World Health Organization. And they are all quite concerned about the amount of consumption by the American public, but also by everybody around the world of these carbohydrate-rich foods that are fried.
You know, I can remember. I think it was probably around the year 2000. I was working with a lot of children with autism in Arizona, and at the time, we were making changes in their diet, and I had one mother who said, but my child is just going to sit there and kick and scream if they can't have it, if I'm pouring punch for everybody else and this child is not getting it. I said, don't bring it into the house. And
don't
says,
pour
do
punch for everybody else.
Just don't bring it. Why is it in your house? I mean, the children don't make the purchasing power. And then she says, well, what do you mean? I said, go to the grocery store yourself. Don't take the kids with you. And when you come home, you say, oops, I forgot, I didn't go down that aisle, I'll get it next time. Do you think a child is going to remember from one day to the next that you forgot it because you didn't go down that aisle? Not usually, So decide what comes in your house and what doesn't come in your house. I mean, I have four kids, and my kids weren't raised on all of this food because it was in the 80s that my kids were raised. So we really didn't eat like this. We lived in the Northeast, around farm country, so that just was the way it is. But I will tell you, as your children get older, my children are now in their 20s and 30s, they don't eat fast food. Hey, we don't have birthday cakes. Birthday cakes was just something that, a birthday cake is something that society has said is important on your birthday. If you choose not to have a birthday cake, you don't have to have a birthday cake. Have something else. We would just go someplace. We might go play hockey or whatever that might be. So really it's up to you as parents to start saying, this is not going to be in my wheelhouse, and I'm going to change it. And that's just the way it is. And when you have young children, if they kick and scream, they'll get tired and they'll fall asleep and they'll be up playing again in an hour. Really? Get over it, sometimes, because
you're right.
Your children have gotten over it. Their children have not recognized that it's something that will go on forever. They get over it very quickly, so don't carry the guilt or don't carry the pressure from people or things around you. If you want to make a choice, make a choice.
That's exactly right. And, we always say, your child will eventually get hungry. They may protest. And they may say, I'm not eating that, and fine. They're not eating
right.
that, but they're not going to get a substitute. They're not going to get, something unhealthy for them. So, they might have a little bit of, they might have an apple. You might put a little almond butter on that apple, and they might be okay with that, fine. But they're not eating that dinner with the broccoli and the tempeh and whatever in it, fine. And the next day, the next morning, they'll have something healthy, and they'll be hungry by then. And so they'll eat that something healthy. And then the next night, maybe they still won't eat that broccoli. But by the third day, and we've seen it happen over and over and over, kids
right.
are going to get hungry. And kids, all of a sudden, they begin to change their taste buds. And now that broccoli tastes really, really good. They love it. And, you know, and then eating something that's unhealthy for them doesn't quite have the same kind of appeal. And, you know, you don't have to forego the birthday cake. There are many, many ways to make something healthy without using processed sugar and processed flour and so on. You can make something special without it being, you know, a birthday cake with, you know, frosting made from Crisco and confectioner sugar and dye. You can actually make things that are special, and the child can help make it too. I think getting children involved in the kitchen is really, really important, and talking to them about how important, you know, these foods are to eat, and how important vegetables are, and and trying different things. And my kids did that. My kids were involved from as soon as they could stand up on a little learning tower at the counter. They were ready to go. They were just trying everything and happy to be part of the whole process. I mean, think about it. I mean, you know, years and years and years and years ago, it was really all about providing food for our families. And so it was about growing the food and processing the food and preparing it and serving it and eating it. And, you know, that was not the only thing that people did, but it was a very important part of their lives. And it made us appreciate food and understand how important it is a lot more than today, where we can just get it. You know, you just plop down a $5 bill and you've got, you know, some kind of a hamburger from who knows where and some French fries and a Coke.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about pesticides and about chemicals. You know, it's so interesting. I'm not sure how old you are, but I remember in the 80s, it was really a big thing about this, having a chemically perfect lawn, where I don't remember where I lived in those years, but everybody was plucking out the dandelions and the weeds, and they had to have a perfect lawn. And we lived on a mountaintop, so if someone had a perfect lawn up on top, it was great because all their chemicals just washed down into everybody else's lawn when it rained. So everybody else downstream got a pretty good perfect lawn too. And it was funny because if there was a house above that one on the top, you would notice that they didn't have a perfect lawn. So whatever you're spraying on your grass or on your lawn or on your farm is going to wash downstream. And that's really important for people to understand that, because if you say, well, I don't spray, well, do your neighbors, does the one across the street, how about the farm across, you know, a half a mile down the road? What are they putting that's up in the air today that seems to have such a great sunset? I love when people say, it's such a great sunset tonight. Did you notice that? Well, really, sometimes that's chemicals and pollution that it's really causing such a great sunset. There was a time period, I think it was in the late 80s, there was so much pollution. That was coming along with the chemical rain then. There was like 2 or 3 years there. It was pretty dangerous. And I don't remember the instance around it, but I do remember people were told if it rains, get in the house. You would notice that there was no autumn that year. All the leaves just died, different things like that. So there is a lot of toxins in the earth that are just like floating around, and to know about this and to be aware of it is really important when you send your kids out to play.
Well, that's so true. I'm familiar with with these pesticides becoming part of our environment. They actually do run off our property. They contaminate our drinking water sources, whether they are groundwater sources or even surface water sources. They'll run off into rivers and streams and so on. But people who are depending on their water from underground aquifers are also playing with fire here by using pesticides, because they do contaminate underground drinking water sources. Pesticides are designed to kill things. They're designed to kill weeds, they're designed to kill insects and turf diseases and so on. We never used pesticides before World War II on our homes and
right.
on our home lawns. But during the war, our chemical industries were very active in developing poisons for use during the war. And after the war, we were looking for new markets. and the new markets originally were the agricultural industry. And the industry basically embraced the use of pesticides after World War II in a very, very big way. And there are some people who are researchers who have seen an increase in human illnesses that are related to pesticide exposures as soon as we started using these pesticides for our, you know, for our crops from our, on our conventional farms. But then after we saturated that market, and they continue to use it, all conventional farms are heavy users of pesticides, then we went to golf courses, and we convinced golf courses that they have these huge tracts of land, and people like to play on perfect grass, and, you know, it's a sport that, you know, unfortunately, is seen as a sport where you want to have a perfect environment for your ball roll on the greens and on the fairway. So this is what happened. And then the first advertisements actually for homeowners' use of pesticides was, do you want your front lawn to look like a golf course? If you look at the old magazines during the early 1950s, you will find that people were coerced basically into doing this, because all of a sudden all their neighbors were beginning to use pesticides, and they felt like, oh my God, in order to keep up with the Joneses, I better do this too. And so that industry just took off. And in fact, the use of pesticides is higher on residential lawns than it is on golf courses or on agricultural lands, which is amazing. So we are really responsible for so much of the contamination of our environment. And many of these pesticides, as you say, are volatiles, so which means that they volatilize into the air, which is what you were talking about, where the the atmosphere is actually contaminated with some pesticide products. But they are carcinogens, they are neurotoxins, they are endocrine disruptors, they are asthmogens, and I know many, many people who have had some very, very serious health impacts from exposure to pesticides used on.
You know, I can remember it was really a sign of affluence in the 60s. If you had a perfect lawn and everything was perfect. And then it was, I mean, the marketing blew up in the early 60s, where everything on TV, every family wanted to have in their house, things from, it was all about brand names, that marketing, things from Clorox to Fantastic to 409 to Tide, you know, all of these things. You had to have them because they were just a sign of that you were with the times, where you were keeping up with the Joneses, you were good to go. And that was really a really, really big market. I can distinctly remember that, because we had some of those things. We didn't have many of them. But, you know, I look under, and I remember a lot of people when they say, well, when you have kids, you need to childproof your house, and the first place you go is under your sink. And I looked under mine. I said, I don't have anything under my sink except garbage bags. What else is under there? You know, I don't have any chemicals in my house. But I can remember distinctly in the 80s, I had chemicals in the house. So not many, but a few. So really, I think it's really about the time and the change in society. Right now is a time in society where we're saying we don't want what we grew up with or what we saw in our house. We want less, and we want our children to have less. So really, you have to go with the flow and say, you know, am I going to continue how I was, or am I going to make a change? And a lot of people now are saying we want to make these changes. That's really the biggest difference.
Well, you want to go from being a good consumer to being a good parent. At this, you know, when we're talking about that, in other words, the being a good consumer means that you're going to buy all the stuff that's advertised, like the 409, like the Scott's, you know, three-step program or four-step program for your lawn. I mean, you're gonna being a good consumer means, you know, you're listening to these advertisers, you're going to your big box stores or your local garden centers, and you're just buying this, and down your grocery aisles, you're going to see all these brightly colored things that are familiar, you know, like Clorox, like, you know, Fantastic, and you know, like all of these different cleaning products. But the cleaning products, you know, manufacturers are not required to disclose the ingredients in their products.
Right.
And cleaning products, I actually go into pretty, you know, extensive detail in this book and show you that there are ways to clean your house without the use of these toxic products. So pesticides outdoors, we need to eliminate them. There are more and more choices that we have today. There are organic landscapers, there is organic fertilizer, there are things like corn gluten, which are really good weed controls that you can put on your lawn. Your child can even help you. That's how non-toxic they are. But
mm-hmm.
when it comes to either cleaning products or then even more importantly, personal care products that you're using on your body and on your child's body, you want to look for things that are bio-based, meaning that they are coming from the earth. So things, the ingredients come from the earth. They either come from marine products or forestry products, botanicals, minerals. And you want to look for these things that come from the earth, that do no harm when we use them in our homes and on our bodies, and that actually do no harm once they've gone down the drain and go back out into the environment. Now, I'm not saying that all natural products are completely harmless. Some people who are asthmatic still can have reactions to essential oils
right.
that are fragrance that are used for fragrances. So you can find these things today because there are more and more people who are becoming chemically sensitive. There are more and more people who understand that these petroleum-based products. Now, everything we've talked about here is petroleum-based here, practically the plastics, the pesticides, the cleaning products, the personal care products. These are all based on petroleum products. And when we stop using petroleum products, then we have safer choices. And that's what you want to look for. And they're available today. And, you know, you can go on our website, not only our Helping to Heal website, which is helping the number 2 heal. So it's helping2heal.org. But our main website is grassrootsinfo.org, grassroots with an S on it, grassrootsinfo.org. There's a tremendous amount of information, including lists, not of all the things that you should avoid, because sometimes that list is overwhelming, but here are the manufacturers that provide products with full disclosure of ingredients, and those ingredients are bio-based. And that's what we recommend. Our thinking is that even if you use a product improperly, even if you use it in its concentrate form, it should still do no harm. And those are the kinds of products that we recommend for use in homes, especially in homes with children, and especially in homes with children who are healing from a serious illness.
Let's, in closing, speak a little bit about radiation and cell phones. You know, I can remember, I think it was about last year or the year before, the walking path around the lake here was closed because they had to raise the levee for flooding. So people started walking down this other path that was in between. There were 2 lanes of traffic on either side, and there was what we call a neutral ground in the middle. In other words, there was grass in the middle. And in the middle of the grass is these huge electrical transmission towers because they bring the energy from across the lake over to the other side. And they're huge, and there's one probably every few hundred feet. I mean, there's a lot of them. And what happens is that people have the walking path. Guess where they walk? Right underneath them. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, are you seriously kidding me? I'm going to walk now underneath this huge transmission of electrical energy grid to go for my daily walk. And I would see people walking there all the time, kids, dogs, elderly people. And I'm just astounded that people don't realize that this is such a big deal.
Well, it is a big deal. Those are high-tension power lines, and they really are irradiating some pretty heavy doses of electromagnetic fields. And that's something that is of concern. We do actually have very, very clear studies that are widely accepted that children who live in homes where there are high-tension power lines right outside their homes have a higher incidence of leukemia. So the leukemia and high tension power lines or electromagnetic fields is fairly well established. Cell phones and other wireless devices are using microwaves or RFR, radio frequency radiation. It's a different type of radiation, but you also, I am sure, have cell phone towers all over the place, which are very hard to avoid. And then inside people's homes and businesses and schools and libraries and hospitals, you have routers. And these routers are like mini antennas. They're like smaller versions of what you have outside, those like those cell phone towers. And these devices actually power your wireless devices, whether it's your laptop or your your iPad or your cell phone. And there is a growing body of science showing that there is harm to the body, what we call biological effects, from exposure, and proximity is everything. The closer you are to these devices or to the antenna, the more exposure and the more harm that may occur. You know, when we first invented the radio back in the late 1800s, it was like this incredible thing where people for the first time were able to hear the inaugural address of a new president. They were able to hear the London Philharmonic or, you know, a comedy show or, you know, a conversation or an interview like we're having today on the radio. And it was really quite miraculous. The problem lies in the transmission. That way you were just receiving radio waves, and that tower could be at a great distance away, several hundred miles. But now we have like these little transmitters right in our hands. And so the transmission is where the radiation is really problematic. And so we are just watching this industry, which is now the most powerful and financially powerful industry in the world, about $3 trillion a year now, the wireless industry. And we're just watching them just with, it's mm-hmm. like uncontrolled, rolling right. out new devices, rolling out more antennas, rolling out more, more, mm-hmm. Routers so that people have access and they have, they have greater reception. You know, we want people to be able to be online anywhere, wherever they are in the world. And in fact, there is a whole contingent of scientists and researchers and medical doctors who are saying, hold on, wait a minute. You know what? We've only looked at how close you have to get to a huge transmitter to make your skin burn. We've never looked at the biological effects. We've never looked at the DNA damage. We've never looked at the single and double strands, DNA strands that are breaking from exposures. We're not looking at the brain tumors, the gliomas and the soft tissue, the gliomas and the acoustic neuromas and then the parotid gland tumors that people are getting from, the ipsilateral exposures on, one side of their head, the side that they're actually using those cell phones on. And we're not looking at the people who are having, neurological effects from living in homes where there are transmitters and smart meters now. The utilities are beginning to put wireless meters on people's homes right. to track their usage of water and electricity and gas. And so this is becoming very problematic for many, many people. More and more people are being diagnosed with what's called electromagnetic hypersensitivity, or EHS. And it is recognized by the Americans for Disabilities Act as a disability now, which means that these people have to be accommodated just the way you would be accommodated if you were in a wheelchair. And so there are some very, very big battles going on between industry and government regulatory agencies and people who are really being negatively affected. And that number is growing exponentially.
If we can look at these new TVs now, because they are really a computer on steroids, and if you stand in front of them, you can feel the radiation, the heat coming off of them. And it's so interesting. If you just shut the thing off for an entire month and check your electric bill, and just turn them on for an entire month and check your electric bill, you'll find it's almost half of your electric bill.
Wow.
And it's incredible if you just plain keep the thing off. And, you know, and what we see now is children, you know, they have to have, they have children's pads now, you know, children's
mm-hmm.
little computer
iPads.
Pads, you know,
mm-hmm. tablets.
And the kids have to have their cell phones or whatever, and it's just, they're really getting instituted into a process that may not be that great for them in the long run. And I think, you know, any little thing that contributes to something that is a potential risk, maybe you might want to say, do I really need to have that in my life? And really, that's what we've talked about this whole hour is, can I eliminate things and not be feeling like I'm missing out or the peer pressure is on me? I'm just going to eliminate it for the safety and the health of my family, and that's really the most important message we can say this whole time.
I agree with you 100%.
Well, Patty, can you share a little bit with the listeners how they could find out more information about you and about your work? That would be great.
Yeah. We have a nonprofit organization, which I mentioned earlier, Grassroots Environmental Education, and that website is grassrootsinfo.org. And then this book has its own website, the Helping to Heal book, which is Helping to Heal, and that's a number two, the numeral two, helping2heal.org. And if you want to know more about the cell phone radiation and just wireless radiation in general, we have collaborated with Dr. Hugh Taylor from Yale University. He's the head of reproductive sciences and OBGYN at Yale Medical School, and Devra Davis from Environmental Health Trust, formerly with the American Academy of Sciences in Washington, D.C. And we have developed a program called the Baby Safe Project. And so it's that website is also fascinating. It's baby, as in B-A-B-Y, safe, S-A-F-E, project.org, babysafeproject.org. And that will give you a lot of information, and that's really the main focus there is the concern about wireless radiation to the unborn child. And so we're trying to educate pregnant women here about avoiding those exposures during pregnancy that may actually affect the normal development of the baby's brain. So there's a lot of information out there. We are a science-based organization, so everything that we have out there for the public is well cited with scientific peer-reviewed studies, academic peer-reviewed studies. And we would welcome any inquiries on any of these issues. You can contact us through the websites, and we're happy to work with people, helping them get a policy in their school to reduce exposures on many, many different issues. In schools in particular, it's, you know, it's idling of school buses. It's the use of synthetic turf and pesticides on lawns and toxic cleaning products. And these things we have been very successful in helping parents, especially of young children, to make changes in their child's environment.
Well, Patty, I think it's very informative. And again, for parents who have children, it's very overwhelming, and we're not meant to overwhelm. We are just here to enlighten and say, just take one little corner, one little page of the book, or one little comment that we've said on the radio and say, I can do this, and see how it resonates with you. And then when you're done with that one, you might be inspired to try something else.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you so much for joining us today. It was a pleasure to have you with us.
You're so welcome. It was really very nice.
Thank you. If you'd like to find out more information about Patty Wood and her book, it is called Helping to Heal. The link is on the bottom of today's show page. Please do click on there and you'll go directly to her website. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's a pleasure to have you with us. And until tomorrow, have a great day.
Today we discussed many life-changing concepts. Who do you turn to, and how do you know what is best when faced with a health crisis? Dr. Jeanette is a patient advocate. She listens to the patient, the doctors, and the family, clarifies the health issues and concerns, then helps the patient make the best choices going forward. If you would like help implementing change into your life and health, we can talk and see where you are stuck and how to improve the quality of your life. Check the link on the bottom of today's show page or visit drjeanettegallagher.com to schedule a phone appointment today.